This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up. Your dinner cannot just be French fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. Hey there, this is John with Gen X Grown Up. You know, one of the coolest benefits of being a content creator is having the opportunity to actually speak with some of the key figures who laid the foundation of the video game industry. And my guest today is without a doubt one of those individuals. He was there in the very early days of Activision when they were forging new ground as the first third-party game developer for Atari and later others. He's the wizard behind such successful titles as Keystone Capers, Pressure Cooker, and Coleco's Donkey Kong, and is still blazing that trail today with other Activision alums over at Audacity Games. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce you to Mr. Gary Kitchen. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
One of the things, I periodically have an opportunity to speak with some of the gentlemen and ladies who were there at the early days of the foundation of this now multi-trillion dollar industry. And something that I'll never experience, something I want to ask you about, what's the experience of having your work from decades ago when you were a very young man still being enjoyed and celebrated today?
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. You'll note in, I don't have a big social media following, but enough that once in a while I'll hear from people. And I always make a point of saying to someone who, hey, I grew up, I played Keystone Capers, I loved your Game Maker, or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I always make a point of saying, you know, it's very kind of you to still recognize something I worked on so many years ago. Because it is very strange. I have to explain it to my family. Why do people think you're famous? What are they talking about? So, you know, but it's one of those things that it's funny.
And on a personal note, I want to take this opportunity. It's the first time we've spoken. And I just want to say thank you for the contributions you made as one of the architects of some of the best parts of my childhood. And now later in life, my adult life, the things I do, I'm grateful for the things that you have done, have contributed to that. And I'm so happy to be talking to you now.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. You know, we didn't know at the time what we were doing. And you look back now and it seems so, you know, fascinating. But when you're doing it in real time, it's just, I mean, it was fun. Don't get me wrong. It was very fun. But it's amazing how much more significant it was than it appeared at the time.
I'm going to quickly take a page out of the old game show, This Is Your Life. I'm sure you've seen that old show. I'm going to go, so Gary, do you remember this old friend?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I do.
So if you're listening, I have the Wildfire LCD pinball machine, which is something that Gary had a chance to work on very early in your career, if I'm right.
Yep. Loved it. It's a classic example of ignorance is bliss. I was too dumb to know that what they were asking me to do was really hard. And if I had known how hard it was, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But you're a kid. You do it.
There you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Many people listening, the big thing they're probably tuning in to find out about is your involvement with the Coleco port of Donkey Kong, one of the greatest arcade games ever known. And there's an ongoing urban legend about its quality, and some people don't recognize the skill involved in accomplishing some of the things that you did with that. Before we talk and clear the record there, which I'm excited to clear because you were the man there, you were the man doing the work, how did you get involved with doing that port for Coleco?
Yeah, it was right place at the right time for the most part. You know, when the machine came out, the Atari came out in the mid-late 70s, it was what you would call a closed system. You didn't go down to the library and get a manual how to program it. You didn't, no one published anything. It was proprietary, it was owned by Atari, and that was that. And the people that wrote games on it were people that worked for Atari. So that changed when my friend David Crane and his compatriots decided in the late 70s to leave and form Activision. So now you had talented people with experience who are now in another company. They went through a process called reverse engineering, which is going all the way down to the chips and figuring out how it works and documenting it to cover themselves that, look, legally, we didn't take anything with us. We walked out the door clean and we figured out everything we had to figure out to do this. And then they started doing games. So that was it. The entire collection of people in the world who did Atari games were the Atari people and Activision. So I was working on Wildfire and other electronic toys. And I started noticing that there was a lot of excitement for this other way to play games on a TV set rather than on an LED screen. By the way, I'm going to correct you. Those are LEDs, not LCDs.
Did I say LCDs?
Yes, you said LCDs.
I even thought about that
you
early
knew
on.
They were LEDs.
How often do I say LEDs in my current life? Thank you. You're very right.
LEDs are red. Those are the LEDs. At least they were red back
That's
then.
That's right.
So anyway, I was working at this company. I didn't own the company. And I went to the bosses and I said, look, it was great. I love doing the electronic toys. I did Bankshot too. And I was working on other ones. And I said, but you got to keep your eye out on that Atari thing going on the West Coast because it's coming like a train. And they were skeptical, but I went out and I bought an Atari. I ripped it open and reverse engineered it. I figured out how it worked, went down to the chip level, dumped a bunch of cartridges with binary code in them, reverse engineered the binary code, read a lot of games. And in about 6 months, I had figured it out and documented how it worked. And then I wrote Space Jockey. And Space Jockey was my first video game. And it was really just an outgrowth of, I'm trying to figure out how the system works. I've got to be doing something. I've got to be putting things on the screen, seeing if I can move them around, see if I can make sounds. So I did I did Space Jockey. And then Space Jockey came out through US Games. And Space Jockey was the first game that came out that, by someone who had reverse engineered the system without any prior knowledge. Activision guys had reverse engineered the system, but obviously they were at Atari. So it was the first one. The only game that came out right before it, I think, was Lost Luggage, which was, who was Lost Luggage? Come on. Can't think of it. Apollo Games.
Said Telsis. Yeah, Apollo. Yeah,
yes. But they had gotten the information because somebody started selling it in the back of Popular Electronics. That's a whole other story for another day, but that was really funny. I sweated for 6 months to figure out every bit and pixel. And then I found out for $20 in the back of Popular Electronics, I could have bought it. Who knew? But anyway, I went through the effort and I learned it. So now I left the company I was with, may have felt I was just a wee bit undervalued. And I was making $11,000 when I did all that. And now I'm doing Apple II games with my brother. And I get a call from someone who said, Coleco is looking for someone to program a game on the Atari 2600. And I'll be damned if I can't find anybody who's independent and available who knows how to program the Atari 2600. Now, let me ask you, at that point in time, how many people were there? It weren't a lot.
Seven, maybe, on the planet?
Yeah, on the planet. And how many of them were actually not employed by Atari or Activision? It was a pretty small world.
You might have been it.
It might have been it. So lo and behold, I made a deal with them to do it. And, you know, it was another ignorance is bliss. Oh, you want me to put that $3,000 machine into this $5 cartridge with 1/100th of the memory? Sure. You know, that's why I signed up.
How hard could that be?
How hard could it be? Right. I mean, I knew the game. I knew the coin-op game. My wife and I had been playing it. We loved it. You know, you couldn't help but love the game. It was the first one that really felt more like a cartoon. It told a story. Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely, you know, it was Mr. Miyamoto at his brilliance before people knew he really, you know, was as brilliant as he turned out to be with all the other things he did. So I jumped at the opportunity to do it. I thought it would be great. I knew it would be hard. It was far harder than I thought.
That comes to the rub. So I'll rewind me to being 11 years old or so. And I remember ordering Donkey Kong out of the back of a magazine, mail order, waiting 4 to 6 weeks for delivery, which is almost invariably 6 to 8 weeks. And I'm dying for it.
Yep.
I knew Donkey Kong intimately like you did. Again, I love the characterizations, the cutscenes, the fact that it was like a cartoon. It told this story. There was a protagonist and an antagonist and a heroine. It wasn't just a spaceship with bullets and aliens, right? And initially, when I got my Donkey Kong, I was crestfallen because even knowing the limitations of the system on which I was purchasing it, somehow the magic of Donkey Kong I thought would just make it everything that I was dreaming. And it was not. It was fewer screens, as we know. It was fewer colors. It was fewer everything through the limitations. Now, I will say, and I mentioned in a previous video, the one that actually got us connected is that many people don't recognize the technical achievements of that Donkey Kong port. Pac-Man, the Todd Fry did, had flicker like bananas. You'd had no flicker.
Yep.
Right, you had an asymmetrical background layer with the layer, the first ramps. Screen that has the up and down. Yep. It is an achievement, and yet it is often looked upon as, oh, what a bad port. How bad is it? To the point that there's a conspiracy theory that, well, Coleco was making ColecoVision, therefore they must have told their developers, put a pin in that, the developer is sitting right here across from me. They must have told the developers, just do a half-assed job because we want our ColecoVision to look good.
Right.
Now, I don't necessarily believe that. It doesn't matter what I believe. We have the authority here. It seems to me they would want to make as much money as they could for as many ports as they could, for as many platforms as they could. So you were speaking with Coleco. You were working for them. What happened with the port of Donkey Kong about around the limitations? Did they intentionally, I'll ask you point blank, did they intentionally say, Mr. Kitchen, just half-ass this and tank it?
Not a chance. Not a chance. There's not an ounce of truth to that rumor. I can tell you exactly what happened.
Wonderful.
I was hired. I had 90 days to do it. That was it. 90 days.
Wow.
There were three cartridge sizes available at that point in time for the Atari. 2K, which I had used on Space Jockey, 4K, and 8K. Yeah. There was no way that they were going to spend another, I don't know what it was, 50 cents, 75 cents on going to the bigger ROM for two reasons. Number one, they knew if they got it into the market in time, you know, if it missed Christmas that year, all bets are off.
Yeah.
As long as it made Christmas and it was out in volume, they were going to sell every unit. Every unit they manufactured, they were going to sell. They knew that. The demand was so high for the product. The only way they wouldn't sell every unit is if it was just garbage. You know, didn't even turn on, had one screen, the graphics were terrible, all that. So long as it was a decent quality game and it made it out in time, they were going to sell every unit. Now, the company was owned at that time by the Greenberg brothers, who had founded the Connecticut Leather Company, which was the name of Coleco, Connecticut Leather Company. They had already had big hits with Cabbage Patch Dolls, among many others.
Right.
So, you know, these guys were smart, savvy businessmen. Now, I didn't have many discussions with them, but I did meet them. And I will tell you that they did hover behind me for the last 3 days of the project when they asked me to come up to Hartford and work in their offices in a cubicle so they could see me finishing it. They wanted to make sure I was doing it, that I wasn't, you know, sitting at home drinking a martini. So I put yourself in their shoes. You have the hottest coin-op license ever. Yep. Space Invaders showed that if you do a good port, you are going to sell an enormous percentage of the machines are going to buy the game. And they know they're going to sell every one they make, as long as it's a decent game. They've already seen that it's becoming a decent game. They're not worried about that. I'm going to make the deadline. They're not worried about that. Would you spend an extra 75 cents a unit if you knew you were going to sell 3 or 4 million units and you own the company? Is it worth it for you to spend an extra 50 or 75 cents per unit?
Those all add up. Will I sell more if I spend that on it? Probably not.
I don't think so. They sold everyone they manufactured. Now, and that's a moot point. That's a moot point. Reason it's a moot point is because you couldn't do more than what I did and make Christmas. Given the time frame when they contacted me and there was a deadline, it took at least 8 to 10 weeks to burn ROMs that had my code in it and go through the manufacturing cycle. So there was no moving the holiday. You had to be in the stores by September, and I started and had to finish by May. That gave them June, July, August to test it, manufacture it, get it in the stores. They could have told me, you have 200K. We didn't change a thing. 90 days, I'm done. I have no more room to fill up the ROM. So it was never brought up in discussion. Quality was never brought up in discussion ever with anyone at Coleco. ROM size was only brought up to the point of, I said, how much ROM do I have? 4K, done. Time, it's got to be done in 3 months. That's it. Those were the only variables that mattered. There was no, can I have more? I think I'm sure, I don't recall, but I'm sure I must have said at some point, boy, I could use 8K. But everyone, you know, well, what's 8K going to buy you? Well, I need 2 or 3 more months. End of story. Let's talk about something else. I don't have two or three more months. If I have two or three more months, game comes out in January. So that was it.
Even if they had given you a larger ROM,
even if they gave me a larger ROM,
it would have been irrelevant. Yeah.
And the other point that's so critical is it's easy in hindsight to look back and create that crazy theory, but they didn't need any help to make the Coleco version look better. I mean, it was the difference between a Ferrari and a bicycle. I mean,
so much more capable.
Look how good the Coleco version looked.
Right.
They knew I wasn't going to do something of the quality of the ColecoVision. It absolutely could not be done. So they weren't worried about it. Mm-hmm. All they were worried about is we are a company. We're a public company. We have shareholders. We're going to make money. And I will tell you that I read an analyst report the following year, looking back on 1982 Coleco. They put out 500 what they call SKUs. You're familiar with the term SKU? A SKU is each product that's in the market.
Yep.
They put out 550 SKUs that year across their entire product line of everything. That single ROM cartridge that I did was 25% of their revenue in 1982.
Wow.
25% of the revenue came from that one cartridge, according to analysts, not me. I think they did about 4 million units before Christmas, $100 million in commercial sales. There was nothing but good thoughts going on here. Nobody was plotting anything. And there were no decisions to be made because there was no other path than the path we took. So put it to bed. Put that one to bed.
There's the word. Can we stop debating that finally? Look, Mr. Gary Kitchen, the man who was there, who did the work, who coded every bit.
Yep.
There was no conspiracy to tank this game. What he actually produced within the limitations was a remarkable game for the day. Do you feel like doing a what if you had had more time and 8K? Do you know what you would have changed or what might have been different? Or
I'm sure in 8K I could have done all four levels. I have no doubt I could have.
Yeah.
Believe me, many times I've thought about flexing my muscles and just bringing up a assembler and starting to write 6502 and doing it just to show that it would have been possible. But
I'd love to see that.
There are a lot of reasons why I wouldn't. Nintendo is a very important client of mine. I do work for them. I would never do anything that would ruffle their feathers, much less copy one of the most popular games they ever did with an unauthorized version. But yes, if I had had the extra ROM and the time, I'm sure I could have done four levels. I wish I had done.
Beautiful.
Would have been great.
Yep.
I mean, I remember when I finished it. It was 3 days before Memorial Day. It was Memorial Day weekend, I think. It was right before Memorial Day, and my contact at Coleco called me and said, you know, management would like you to come up to Hartford. And I was in New Jersey at the time. So I said, fine. Drove up to Hartford. I understood, you know, there's a lot of money riding on this sucker. Brought my equipment with me. I used an Apple II computer to write the code. So I brought it all up. I set it up in a cubicle. I sat down. I didn't move for 3 days. 72 hours I sat in that chair, except for going to the bathroom and having people put food in front of me. I never got up. And they would walk behind me and look over. No one ever talked to me. Just, how's it going? You know. And it was done. I released the ROM, I think probably Memorial Day. It was 3 days. And then my first wife I was married to then, Renee, flew up from New Jersey to Hartford, flew up to, you know, spend a couple of days up there now that I was done. I went and picked her up at the airport. I walked up to the gate and she practically fainted. She said, you look white. You look like a ghost. Because I hadn't, you know. I was dead. I hadn't slept in 3 days. So our big fun weekend was going back to a hotel where I slept for like 3 days. What are you going to do?
Coleco had the golden goose chained to the desk for 3 days.
They did.
They knew, it was they very knew what fun. They had. Yeah.
So, you know, I look at it and that game was, I got no complaints from anybody on that game for years. I'll tell you a story. The night I knew it shipped was a couple months later, it was September. Somehow I found out through people I knew that it had shipped. So I went to the local Sam Goody. You remember Sam Goody? They sold music.
Audio
but they also
records,
sold video
tapes.
Games. Yeah. Everybody sold video games
everybody
at
did.
That point. The gas station sold video games. So I went to the local Sam Goody to see if the game was out. I'm not kidding you, John. I've never had a night like that. I walked in the same goody with a couple of friends and my wife, and they had the game up on a TV behind the register. So it was the front area where you paid, and it was a big TV, not a big TV, you know, 24 inch or whatever, running up there. And there had to be 50 people gathered around that checkout area, just ogling, looking up at it like, oh my God.
What was that like for you?
I couldn't believe it.
That was your work.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. It was just people just looking at it like, gimme, how fast can I have it? You know? And I went home and said, I always said that was pretty good. And then a good friend of mine, woman I knew, didn't really play video games much. She's a few years older than me, and she had a kid, but she was a friend of the family. Went over to our house one day for like dinner or something, and it's sitting there. And I said, you play that? She goes, yeah, it's the only game I play. I bought an Atari to play it. She goes, I love Donkey Kong. And she said, I said, I wrote that game. And she goes, yeah, right. I said, I did. And she goes, you actually wrote that game, that one right there? She said, I played 3 hours a day. So I thought that was pretty funny. She didn't even know. She didn't know what I did. So, you know, I didn't have people coming over to me and saying, where are the other two levels?
Right.
That didn't happen. I didn't have people coming over and saying, the gorilla looks like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. And I knew he did, but I couldn't do any better than that. So, you know, it's hindsight. It's so easy in hindsight to say it could have been much better. You know, it's the answer is it could not have been any better. It could not have been any better. It is the best
thing we've
done in 90 days.
We're still playing it today and enjoying it. So like we said at the beginning,
what was important to me is it
later,
felt really
good. We haven't
forgotten it. It felt, I spent a lot of time tuning the jump and tuning the timing of jumping over the barrels where it was hard, but it was as hard as the arcade game. I had an arcade game next to me while I was doing it, by the way. I had one sitting next. So I didn't have code. I didn't have assets. I didn't have graphics. None of that stuff would have been helpful, but I had the game and I could play the game. And so I really went for the feel and the feel was good.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
So let's shift gears now. Now that we've put Donkey Kong to bed, let's shift gears and talk about Activision. So some of the other seven people on the planet we were talking about had formed this company. And I understand you came in very early, not at the very beginning, but very, very close to the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they would think early in the beginning. They were 100 people when I came in. Now they started, they were 10 people, 8 people, 5 people. They were in David Crane's spare bedroom. but yeah, I was fairly, the way I count it is designers. The original four were there and then they hired Steve Cartwright, who was a good friend of David Crane. And they brought him in and he became that designer, fifth designer. Think Carol Shaw came in right then. And then
River Raid.
That was the group. And then I called on the main line and asked for the head of product development, told him what I was doing. He thought I was lying until I told him I had just finished Donkey Kong for Coleco, and suddenly his interest level peaked. And I had a group. I already had a group of four guys, and they loved the idea of a group of four guys. They loved the idea of a group of four guys 3,000 miles away, because the last thing they wanted was to affect the chemistry of their team. They had this team in a lockdown door that no one could go in, where they had their chemistry. They played games. They kibitz. They talked about how hard the games were. They played each other's games. You know, they were their own tough audience. And last thing they wanted was bringing a stranger, sticking in the room with them. So when they heard 3,000 miles away, four guys, hire them all. Just, you know, we don't want them anywhere near us, but give it a shot. So I called them. We talked to Atari, too, at the same time. We went back and forth between the two. We came out to California. We spent some time with Atari. Came out, spent some time with Activision. At the end of the day, I think we bonded with Activision guys a little more, respected the quality of their work. And for a lot of reasons, not financial at all, but for other reasons, just you know, what they were doing, type of games they were doing and all that. You know, we went with Activision.
And I would expect the core of Activision was not interested in letting that talent go to the company that had treated them poorly enough that they left on their own.
So. Oh, yeah. They definitely didn't want us to join Atari. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And it was funny because had we joined Atari at that moment, we would have stepped into the role that General Computer ended up stepping into. I don't know if you know that story. The GCC guys from up in Cambridge ended up becoming their big contractor and doing a lot of the great port work. They ended up doing the 7800 platform. Mm-hmm. That was after us. They were really trying to position us for that role. They wanted us to hire people, build it out, and really fill a big part of their product strategy. But it
would be this autonomous brain trust that would come in and just fill that hole. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Good.
Lucky us that it didn't.
Well, you know, who knows what you got there. But we were certainly happy. We joined June 1st, 1982.
So while you were there, I know Keystone Capers, one of the most popular Activision titles. You're responsible for Pressure Cooker a little bit later in during Activision. Of those or other stuff that you worked on that I didn't mention there, what are your best memories or takeaways from having worked with Activision in those early days? I mean, you were laying the groundwork, as I was saying earlier. There was no such thing as a third-party developer, really, until Activision said, you know what we could do? And now here you are with those guys. What's your takeaway from those projects?
That was the best time. It was the glory days.
Love hearing that.
Absolutely the glory days. Because we had looked from afar at their success. We were blown away by the quality of their games. When we found out they existed, I was at the store and I saw Skiing had come out.
Yeah.
And that was the first I had heard of Activision. And I looked at it and said,
might have been their first title, second maybe? It was very
early. It was pretty early. I looked at it and said, what the hell is this? It's an Atari game, but it's not by Atari. And the whole concept of third-party of publishing didn't exist. I mean, you bought Magnavox, you bought Magnavox games. You bought an Atari, you bought Atari games. So I just looked at it and said, what is this? And it's got to be garbage. So I bought it, went home, called my brother, said, get your butt over here. It's got to be a piece of trash. So we sat there all ready to laugh, plugged it in, and it blew us away how good it was. It's just Wow.
I'm going to tell you how satisfying it is for me to hear that games that I am playing, like I think of Keystone Capers, probably the one I played the most of your titles from Activision. There's a playfulness to it. There's a fun to it that comes through in a platform that doesn't lend itself to generating playfulness and fun in that kind of cartoony way that you were able to generate. And knowing what you just told me, that it was one of the most enjoyable experiences doing that, I have to think that came through in your work. It was fun. Therefore, the game was fun. There was a playful attitude. Therefore, the game feels playful. I just think even like the hop routine for the Keystone Cop and Keystone Capers, that isn't even just a couple of years earlier with Donkey Kong, it's two positions, down and up. And then I look at Keystone Capers and there's an arc to his jump that you then bake into a mechanic into how you navigate and jump and duck things.
Yeah.
That must have come from how much fun you were having. You wanted to put that extra effort into it. Am I close?
Yeah, I set out to do a game that was whimsical and funny.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't need to do the 412th shooting game or space game or whatever. I wanted to do something that was whimsical and fun. And I think the reason I landed on Keystone Cops was David Crane and I have a rule with the Atari 2600. If I try to draw it and you can't tell what it is, it doesn't go in the game. And that's the problem with a lot of 2600 games. You look at something and go, what is that? Is that a car or a bird? you can't really tell. So, I wanted to do a character. I knew it was going to be a little man running game because I had just done Donkey Kong. So I had little man running games on the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a bunch of little men. And the distinctive bowler hat was the one that made you say, oh, that's a Keystone Cop. I said, sold. And he was funny to boot. So, that's really how it happened. And Dave came out within a month of us joining. Dave came out. And, I have to say, we were completely terrified. I mean, the god of video games is coming to our office in New Jersey. We were terrified. I mean, sure, I had done Donkey Kong, but that was not there was no big deal. I was not a big deal. We were just a bunch of kids who had just learned how to program the Atari, and David Crane's coming out, and we were literally terrified. And it was funny. It was he had just been on the cover of Delta's In Flight magazine. He'd been on the Today Show. It was like, God help us,
Crane's a celebrity.
Crane's coming. Everybody hide. And you know, we had a good time looking at it. And when I started programming it, I originally had the cop climbing up a building, more like Crazy Climber. I wasn't influenced by Crazy Climber, but that was just what I thought. And it was a department store climbing up the building. The guy was above him, carrying items, throwing them down on him to stop him from chasing them. And Dave looked at it and said, you know, take a look at Jungle Runner, this game I'm working on, Pitfall. maybe it would work well if it was side to side rather than vertical. And I said, yeah, I'll buy that. So I switched it.
There you are.
And the other driver on that game was I had to do a game that had an escalator in it because I had done the escalator fooling around. I've had this thing about doing mechanical animations and mechanical things. I mean, that's my thing. I love if I can write an algorithm and make something like the Burger King grill where the patties go over a flame and then drop down. That drives the idea of the game. And I said, I'm going to try an escalator. I'll bet I could do an escalator. And I worked a long time on it, got it perfect, and said, all right, now I need a game. Well, I got a Keystone Cop. I got an escalator. All right.
There you go.
I got it.
It's He's a department game. Store.
Yeah.
There you go. So is that – I'm not an Atari developer by any stretch, but you only have one on the screen at a time, and I'm guessing you're using background elements, but using racing the beam and using interrupts to change when it's drawn to make that move up. I don't know.
No background elements. No background elements.
No? Okay. No.
It's, you know, the ball is just a strip down the screen that could be 1, 2, 4, or 8 bits, or maybe 1, 2, 4 bits, not even 8. So if you take the ball and you think about how David Crane did the swinging vine.
The swinging vine was the ball.
The ball, click, 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 just shifting pixel. So what I did is I used the ball and I said up 4, shift 4, up 4, shift 4, up 4, shift 4.
That's great.
And then I masked the side of it with another object. So it looks like they're sticking out. And then I just, at the top of the loop, just cycle through 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it ripples down the screen. Really, Beautiful. It's not hard.
Yep. It is remarkable to look at. Keystone Capers is another one of those that I remember looking at and going, is this really running on my Atari?
Yeah, I really worked hard to get that feeling. One thing, I'm obsessive about certain pieces of quality, at least Dave, this is why I got along with Dave so well, is because we have these same philosophies, that there are these a million little things you do in a game that no player will ever point out, but it's why they love the game. It's little touches, little features that are important to us, and they really make the difference between an average game and a quality game. I was obsessed. I have this thing scrolling up there for the escalator, and Keystone Kelly can run toward it and jump. Is he going to land right on the step, or is he going to end up landing in the middle of it and going click, and I have to force him onto a step? And I said, I'm not doing that.
So you have to adjust that to make it look natural.
I adjusted it. And you can sit there all day long and jump on that, and he will always land perfectly on a step. And that was so hard to do. It was harder to do than the escalator. But I did it because I said, I have to do it. It's going to bother me for the rest of my life if I don't. So I did it. And, you know, those are the little things you remember. It's so funny.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show too. It helps more than you know.
So you were there with Activision. You started in 82, as you said. The entire industry had a big shakeup by about a year later.
Yeah.
The summer of 83 and the North American crash started to decline. Atari was imploding. Activision, however, wisely took a shift toward computer games. Now, they didn't stop with the 2600 VCS development, but you then shifted into that. So my impression, you were under this umbrella of Activision that was smart enough to smell the blood in the water and kind of change course to preserve themselves. What was the experience from inside? Did you realize it was happening
in the moment? Was it a conscious decision, or were you just market adjustments? Or do you remember what that was like?
No, it was a conscious decision. It was, you know, and we had a different view because we were in a satellite office. We're in New Jersey in this beautiful office, really nice space, brand new building, beautiful space, probably five times the size we needed for the amount of people we had. But they treated us really nicely. And they came out and said, we're going to shift to computer software now, right now, right now. And think about things besides games, because we've got to expand out into computer software is much more than games. So no, it was very conscious. Honestly, it was an overreaction.
You think so?
Think about things beside games. No, the games won't go away.
Didn't really.
No. See, there was a crash, but no one knocked on people's doors and told them there was a crash. People still wanted to play games. Right. They just figured out they couldn't buy them anymore for a while. Toys R Us actually called us. We were in a very interesting position. We were in Glen Rock, New Jersey, where our office was, and Toys R Us's national headquarters were the next town over, Paramus, New Jersey. Okay. So, and our sales guy went to Toys R Us all the time, and I went to Toys R Us with him on occasion and met with the buyer of video games. And so we were tight with them. And my sales guy told me one day, he said, you know, I was in Toys R Us, and you're going to laugh, but they said, why isn't anybody putting out 2,600 games anymore? He said, they're getting so
Toys
many
R Us didn't
requests.
Know. They didn't realize.
And we said, really? We can do 2,600 games. So we ended up doing them out of our little office in Glen Rock and selling them under our Absolute brand. And then Activision called us and said, we want to do some 2,600 games. You guys are doing them, right? We said, yeah. I said, why don't you just do them yourself? And it was a little lean toward the phone and whisper because the company had just been bought, gone through a pseudo bankruptcy, been bought, moved to Southern California. Mm-hmm. We're a different company now. They said, no one here knows how to do them. We don't have the manuals. We don't have the development systems. We don't have the technology. It's not a person in the building who could do a 2,600 game. Can you guys know?
Oh.
We said, yeah, sure, we'll do. And then we got a call from Atari who said, can you do 2,600 game? So at one point, our little Absolute office in Glen Rock, New Jersey, Midland Park, probably at that point, was doing all the 2,600 games that came out. This was during the time frame when Kung Fu Master, Ghostbusters, skateboarding, F-14 Tomcat, that whole games came out in like the 80, what was it?
Late 80s.
85, 86, 87, 88,
right in there? Was that
that time frame? We were doing all of them for everybody because we were the only ones who still knew how to do them. It was so funny.
There you go.
It's very funny.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at genxgrownup.com.
Let's fast forward to the 21st century now, which one of the coolest things I heard about in relation to Activision and my beloved. Now, homebrew is not a new thing, but I heard about this little company called Audacity Games. And I'm like, yeah, we don't need another independent homebrew company. Yeah, who founded it? Wait a minute. Who founded it?
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
The Kitchens? Crane?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have my Circus Convoy here from Audacity Games.
Bless
I'll probably
your soul.
Show you. I have my patch as
yes,
well.
He has a patch too. Excellent.
So I got my letter with your photocopied autograph on there. Thank you so much.
Yep.
But this is, for those listening, I'm holding up a copy of Circus Convoy here. This is a game published by Audacity Games that, correct me, this is yourself, Gary, your brother, I believe, and David Crane founded this company? Is that
yeah,
accurate?
Actually, David Crane and I founded it. Dan had independently been working on 2,600 games, so eventually it became apparent that he should just, you know, there was too much overlap that we're not both going to make a tool to make plastic and do five, you know, four color boxes and do, let's do it together because it's a matter of scale. So he joined soon after. Yes, very closely, I guess, to when we launched the game. Okay. The game was 3 years in development before anybody ever knew Audacity existed.
Mm-hmm.
We had decided.
And Circus Convoy is a tremendous game. It is, again, memory limitations, and you took the time you needed. It feels like a blending of so many of the best parts of what we saw from Activision games. You can definitely see Keystone Caper DNA in this game.
Right.
But you also can see some Pitfall DNA in this game with in terms of the exploration. But then there's a complexity of inventory systems and key and lock combinations. I don't mean literal keys and locks, but an element that you need to take to the right place, almost like a point-and-click adventure would introduce, but you're doing it all with a joystick and a button. And then you devise this genius QR code thing to be able to log high scores, you know, in the real world, on the internet, in the modern day. I want 50 more of these, Gary. These are tremendous. Now, I know there's another one, Casey's Gold, you've been talking about for a while. Can I ask you about that and how that's coming along? Is that coming along? What do you think is going to happen with that one?
Yeah, it's coming along. It's been coming along. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. Dan, before he joined Audacity, decided to pre-market it. He started talking about it. He started showing screens. Mm-hmm. He started doing a lot of excellent promotional work that really pre-sold the game. You know this. I know it. Painfully yeah. know it, how pre-sold it is. Dave and I took the opposite approach. Dave and I had been going to these weekend game shows, maybe 2-3 a year. You know, we go, we sit mm-hmm. on a panel. People ask us. We tell stories. We don't mind telling yeah. stories. We enjoy it. Yeah, we sign a few
autographs. I'm the one sitting in the audience. I know. Yeah.
It's great. It's fun stuff. But people kept saying, hey, you've seen Homebrew. Why don't you guys do a game? And we just go, yeah, right. you know,
at the point you were already working on
it. We have day jobs.
Yeah, you're already working on it.
Well, we were working yeah. on it for 3 years. But originally when people were telling us, we said, no way. We're not going to do it.
Oh, okay.
We just didn't want to. It was too much work. I mean, and then we would sit around and talk and go, you know, I bet we could knock one out in 3-4 months. And then they would say, hold on a minute. What makes you think it's any easier now than it was in 1982? And I said, mm-hmm. yeah, it's not. Probably harder. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, so forget 3-4 months. And then one day we came back from a show and we work together. We have a company, we do consulting and also mm-hmm. we're connected at the hip on that front. So it just so happened, we came back from a show, people were really pounding us about it. We said, no, no, no. And it turned out there was some bandwidth on our consulting. We had some time off in between more jobs. More Dave than me. I was busy, but he had. And he said, you know, if we were going to do it, he goes, I'd have to build all new tools and it would have to be great or we wouldn't do it. We couldn't do anything mm-hmm. half-assed. That would be the worst thing we could do. And right. I said, yeah, I agree. And he said, maybe we should start thinking about it. So he had a few months off and he wrote a sophisticated graphics and animation tool specific to the 2600 that does things that help you do more sophisticated characters, like the snake in that game, mm-hmm. Or the giraffe, or the big clown head, things that you could never, you would never see them.
I hate that clown head.
I know. So
he's a pain in the butt.
We started, but we said, we don't tell anybody. Don't tell a word to nobody that we're doing it. And there's no deadline. We're not going to put it out next year, the year after. No deadline. We're just doing it. Mm-hmm. And then when we had time, we worked on it. When we didn't have time, we worked our day jobs, paid the bills. Mm-hmm. And eventually, a couple of years in, started to look like a game. And mm-hmm. then we started to push each other. I would say, needs more mini games. One mini game isn't enough. Needs another mini game. Mm-hmm. Really need 2, 3, 4 mini games. And
it's got 4 or 5 or, yeah.
Dave would call me and go, are you kidding me? No way. I said, Dave, we have to make sure that we hit the bar so high that no one will say they're disappointed. Has to be that much better mm-hmm. than anything else we've ever done. And the amount of work that went into all the things you don't see are insane. There was no manufacturer of plastic cartridges. That didn't exist. There was none. No, none. There were no cartridges to be had. You know, when Atari Age was putting out Homebrew, they bought old Combats, ripped them open, took the thing off, and put them in Combats or put them in other mm-hmm. used cartridges. And we said, we're not doing used cartridges. We're doing new plastic. So mm-hmm. we spent the money. Dave designed a tool, a 3D, you know, tool, which is a thing you need in injection molded plastics to do a cartridge. Right. And for a long time, we always said, oh, I wish we could do games. Yeah, but we don't have a tool. This was a running joke for 20 years. Yeah, but nobody ever did Atari because they don't have a tool. Tool was this thing like, oh, Jesus, you have a tool. That's the end of the world. And one day we just looked at each other and said, why don't we just do a tool? What are we talking about? It's not that hard. That costs money. It costs some serious money to design a tool. But we designed a tool. We had it made. and we can make our own plastic. And we said, well, now we're committed. And we said the boxes are going to be as good as the Activision boxes. They're going to be four color. Mm-hmm. The labels are going to be four color. We're not going to use the same glue that Activision used because we don't want that bumpy problem. We're going to have a poster in the box. We're going to have collector's items. We're going to have authenticity. We're going to have holograms on the front of the box that have your serial number. Every cartridge has its own unique serial number in it. Every cartridge is personalized. Beautiful. Every cartridge has an RFID chip in it. Bet you didn't know that. You know those chips that they use in retail stores on your clothes when you buy clothes, and it beeps when you go out because you know they didn't scan it right? Everyone has one of those in it so that we can take a game that's – you bought a game. You got serial number 473, which may be important to you if you're a collector because you don't want serial number 2000. You want serial number 200 or 100 or 80 or number one. You want a low serial number. Well, a low serial number is in the cartridge. It's tied to your account because you bought it. And when we go to ship it, all we have to do is take an electronic reader and scan the box. And it comes up and prints a code, prints the label of where it's going to. It knows who you are. And when you submit high score, the RFID chip tells us whose game it is, posts the score to that person. So all this back end had to be built to do this. And Crazy Dave did all the back end because I was busy making money to pay the bills, pay my bills and his bills because he wasn't working. But yeah, it was an incredible amount. Dave will go on for hours about the amount of work that the back end took. But in the end, we ended up with a system that works really well. And you asked, that all started because you asked about, what was that game? What was the name of that game? I can't remember that game. What was that game you mentioned?
Oh, I'm sure. Casey's Gold.
Yeah. Casey's Gold.
Have you heard of it?
Casey's Gold is in development. Casey's Gold is going to come out at some point. But the same way.
Fair enough.
Same way we did it with the other game. We're not saying when.
When it's ready.
Now, we are going in a couple of weeks to, what is it, Corks in Ohio? We're going to be there. Me, Dave, and Dan. And we're going to be on a panel. Mm. And there might be news.
You're not going to make any announcements at that panel, are you?
We might make announcements.
You're killing me, Gary.
We might make announcements. And I'm not saying that announcement has anything to do with Casey's goal. But we might make announcements at that panel.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/patreon.
A huge part of being a kid and playing Activision-specific games, and I mentioned this a second ago, was get a certain score and get a patch, and you even did that.
We had to.
With Circus Convoy.
Because we knew how much people loved them. We knew people loved them.
Yes. Yes, we love them. And not only a patch, it's manufactured just like the cheap Activision patches. Yeah. It's not above, it's not below. It fits in. Yeah. It looks exactly. It matches. I could go and get my vest from when I was 12 and it would match all other patches I might have on there from Activision.
Yep.
Because it's the same. It's the same. It's so
same.
Cool.
It had to be
the same. How important was it to you to do that with your titles here?
We figured if we're going to go through the trouble of putting 3 years into a game, we got to recreate the experience. It's not just the game. It's the experience. That's why we didn't go digital. I mean, if you buy a collector's version of Circus Convoy, you will get a digital file that you can play on emulators. Yep. You got the collector's version. And that's great. But we didn't go digital only because digital only cheapens the whole thing. You want the box. Yep. You want the manual. You want the patches. You want all that stuff.
I want the poster. I want the certificate of authenticity.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You want all of it. You want all because that's – so many people come to me and say, God, I thought I was 12 when I got it. I was 12 years old. I was under the tree at Christmas. It's the same experience. You know, it's the same experience.
It's just I forgot to open it for 40 years. That's all.
Yeah, that was it.
The same thing.
That was it. But there are more games coming. Games. I said games. There are more games coming.
To that end, I have one more question about Audacity to ask you before I let you go. Okay. You've been so generous with your time. I have heard rumors that our good friend John Van Ryzen put together a lovely follow-up to Hero with a very similar engine called Alien Abduction, and that perhaps he was talking to you guys about a distribution model. Can you comment on that or no?
Well, it came out, right? It came out from Atari. Didn't he go with Atari?
It digital only. It's a VCS title. Yeah.
Okay. I
heard
the
VCS? That perhaps I do. Yeah.
Is it good? Is it a good title?
It's pretty damn good. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. I haven't played it. Yeah, no, I talk to John periodically. I mean, you know, John, we'll just leave it.
It's what you said. It's that physical release people are craving.
I've seen
here are
say
original
that.
Activision alums putting out quality stuff.
I mean, if we were going to ever think about that, it's hard because it's already come out. And it was pirated. I heard it was badly pirated off the VCS one. People pulled it out and distributed the 2600 version, which is really bad because it cheapens the title. But anyway,
that crushes the model.
I haven't heard that rumor. Okay. I have seen people in a while in the forums say he should go to Audacity and get them to do a physical version.
That's where the rumor came. Hey, this chance to talk to you is all about crushing rumors. There's another one we just laid to rest. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen. It's not something that's coming up. Yep. So.
Are you going to be in Ohio on June 1st? How far are you from
I don't
from
know
Ohio?
Yet. I'm not currently going. I'm in Florida. I'm down in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
All right.
But I have good friends in Ohio. So, you know, maybe I could have a place to crash if I made it up there. I'll have to give the guys a call. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll be doing, we're also doing a show in, what's a show coming up in Austin? July? Is a show like in Austin,
in July?
Texas? July, August.
I don't know that one. I know the East Coast ones. I'll be at Southern Fried Gaming Expo in July. I'll be at Long Island Retro in August.
All right. Well, tell those guys to invite us.
Okay. Yeah. We talk to them.
I mean, usually anybody invites us, as long as it's a decent side show, we'll go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because we enjoy it. Yep. It's not work for us.
Gary, I cannot thank you enough for making the time to speak with me. It has been a total pleasure from this side of the camera. It's so nice to get a chance, as I said earlier, to sit down and talk and meet. Look, I have the games. I've memorized the games. I've played them my whole life. But learning about the man behind the games, learning the history, learning that legacy, it's that documentarian kind of thing in the back of my head that, like, I want to learn the actual facts about how it got to me.
Yep.
And you've given me that. You've given my audience that. I'm so thankful that you took the time. So two thank yous. First, thank you again for all the work you did contributing to my childhood and some of the best parts of my life. And thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk with me here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Look, without you and guys like you, this legacy wouldn't last, right? People wouldn't know from Adam. I wouldn't get to sign 11 autographs when I go to Ohio. Or 15, maybe. I don't know if it's a good day.
You're right.
And I don't charge for autographs, by the way. I see these people charging $50 or $100 for autographs. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Come on, give me a break. Mm. So I am incredibly appreciative of the real enthusiasts who keep this retro industry alive by doing trading and talking and interviewing. And we owe you, not the other way around. So I appreciate you having me on. And you can get Crane on next. I'll bust his ass.
All right, hook me up.
Get him to come on.
All right. I'll do it.
Dan, you'll end up covering all of them.
I'm there.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, thank you.
Take care. Yep.
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. No more washing shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be
french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.